The Breckshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Breckshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. I am Aisha, and in the studio with me this evening is Matt Boothman.
Good evening.
And Andy Crane.
Hello.
Our wonderful sound extraordinaire from the Breckshaw team. So coming up this week on the show, we are we sad to see the end of Great Expectations, Andy?
Sad's probably the wrong word. I think it's
It's
been a labour of love. I'm quite excited to get the last episode out there. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Triumphant.
Yeah. That's a good one, yeah.
We are very, very happy with how Great Expectations has been running. So this is episode 7. It is the longest of all the episodes. It is the last and final episode. And that'll be coming to you in the latter half of the show. We're also going to be hearing from Matt, who doesn't have a promo
No jingle this week. But
I've lost me jingle.
But we have all put our trousers back on.
Yes. Yes, we have.
If you haven't listened to the show before, that's going to be very weird out of context.
We were going to get Andy to do one, but I feel like we might put him on the spot too much to do a promo that leads into film review. So don't worry, Andy, it's fine.
Thank you. It's a relief.
Yeah. What are you doing, Matt?
So I want to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Okay.
And I think we might be segueing a little bit into some London Has Fallen as well, which I know people have been looking forward to since we mentioned it a few shows ago.
So the Breckshaw Arts Hour was on hiatus 2 weeks ago, and that was the time that we were planning on doing a review of London Has Fallen. I made Matt go and see this film. I wanted to go and see it, and I feel really bad that we didn't actually do the review on the show.
Yeah.
So we're going to tack it on to the end.
We're going to do a little review doubleheader for you.
Yes.
So 10 Cloverfield Lane, first of all. So this is the sort of sequel to 2008's Cloverfield, which was a giant monster movie. This is not a giant monster movie. I think it's quite nice that in the world that we're in of all these massive franchises, Batman v Superman and the Justice League being the one that's in the headlines at the moment, but the big Marvel franchises and everybody trying to get these very tightly plotted film series together where every single one sort of drops hints about the next one. I think it's quite nice that we've got these two movies that are sort of thematically linked by that title and by the production house, Bad Robot, J.J. Abrams' production house, but that are only sort of thematically linked rather than trying to exist in this coherent universe. It's almost like the Black Mirror or Inside Number 9 of movies. If those are TV references people get. So the situation in 10 Cloverfield Lane is Mary Elizabeth Winstead is Michelle. She is running away from her fiancé for reasons we don't know. She gets run off the road and wakes up in a bunker with John Goodman. And John Goodman and another guy who is sort of largely irrelevant. But John Goodman says that there has been an attack and that they have to stay in the bunker because everything outside is contaminated, and if they take a single step outside, they're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, it's a tight three-hander movie. Those three people are basically all that's in it. Most of it takes place in that bunker, and it's kind of a puzzle box mystery movie where you're constantly guessing, has there really been an attack outside, or is John Goodman keeping these two people in his bunker for other reasons? Is he the sort of generally kind and paternal but slightly socially awkward character that he seems to be at some points, or is he the sort of creepy, almost maybe psychopathic character that he seems to be in other moments?
Right.
So it's kind of a horror movie and a mystery movie, but the main mystery is about Howard, not about what's going on outside, and the horror is less about what's going, you know, the potential plague or contaminant or whatever it is outside the bunker, and more about the domestic horror of three people who don't really get on having to play Monopoly together.
That is my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
That's horrible. I hate Monopoly.
I actually flinched when Emmett, the third character in it, mentions he spots a game of Monopoly on the thing in the bunker during an awkward pause and suggests that they play, and I went, "Ugh!" And that was almost the most scared I was in that. Like, it's a sort of bubbling tension rather than a shock
right.
movie.
It's reminding me just like at the moment about of like the first ever movie of Saw. It's like
a little bit,
yeah, kind but of less horror-y.
Yeah, better acted than the first Saw, but similarly, similarly kind of high concept.
Sure. Okay.
And very kind of limited and claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
So we get sort of drip fed the little details about the attack and about John Goodman's character Howard, mm-hmm. and about what might be going on, and it I think it's very well paced out in that way. The ending is a little bit of a Shyamalan twist,
right?
And I think if this had been an M. Night Shyamalan movie, then people would be saying, oh god, the ending is so rubbish because it's M. Night Shyamalan.
Really?
I accepted the ending more readily because it was because the movie was already associated, however tangentially, with Cloverfield.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's set up as a sort of sequel to Cloverfield, I was already in the mindset of this is a universe where giant monsters can come up out of the sea and trash Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I will kind of swallow whatever I'm given as the ending.
Right.
So I don't know if you haven't seen Cloverfield or if you're just seeing this on its own, it might be that the ending might be hard to swallow, and
yeah.
I'd be interested to hear from anybody who has seen it isolated in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it's like I say, it's kind of it's a horror movie and a mystery movie that is very sort of turned inwards, even though there is this big external threat. But it's also a movie about what you do when there is danger and when there is threat, and whether you're the sort of person who flees, as Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character certainly is at the beginning, or whether you're the sort of person who bunkers down and tries to weather it and stays where you are, which Howard and Emmett both are, or whether you're the sort of person who goes towards the danger to try to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of whether any of them are going to become that sort of person by the end of the movie is kind of the question of it.
All right. So what is the, you say, tangible link with Cloverfield? Because I really liked Cloverfield. I thought it was, you know, it was watchable. It yeah. wasn't awesome.
I rewatched it recently because I knew I was going to go and see this.
Yeah.
I think it does kind of stand up.
Yeah. What is the link? Because what you've just described doesn't sound like any kind of, like, is there like throwbacks to like, oh, remember when this cool thing happened? Like,
no, there aren't. Cool, so the title is the most obvious link. To come up with any other links, I probably will have to go into spoiler territory, which I'm comfortable doing if you want to.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to go out of my way to say it. That's
okay,
what I mean.
So spoiler warning for the twist ending is it's basically that there has been an alien invasion.
Sure.
And the aliens that Michelle finds when she does eventually escape the bunker at the end are quite reminiscent in their look and sort of biology,
okay,
of the Cloverfield monster. So
right.
if they are supposed to exist in the same universe, rather than it being that kind of Black Mirror anthology thing,
mm-hmm.
where they're kind of presenting a similar worldview but not actually set in the same universe,
mm-hmm.
if they are actually in the same universe, then it's maybe the suggestion that the Cloverfield monster was like the vanguard and the first,
right.
the first alien to land, and then the rest came.
So yeah, he like hung around and then
yeah,
bought his
so
mates.
It's like the continuation of the invasion.
Right, I see. I don't know how I feel about this. it sounds kind of, I don't know. There's probably a lot more to it than what I think, but it sounds a bit meh.
Yeah, it's a good character study, and everybody in it is on top form.
Yeah, what are the performances like?
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah.
John Goodman, like I say, really keeps you guessing. There are moments where he kind of becomes sort of a bit more open and vulnerable and seems to have a side that you could maybe sympathise with, and other points where he almost sort of is the monster, if you think of this as a monster movie.
Mm.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead is sort of, she's somebody who is in a very difficult situation where she has been made very vulnerable. She's injured in the car crash, so she's limping for the entire movie, but is also very resourceful and trying to make the best of the situation, but also constantly kind of thinking, what can I do to, you know, what are my contingency plans here if things go very wrong?
Mm-hmm. How does the female-male character play out?
Is she
quite a strong female character?
Yeah, and it is addressed, the fact that she is a woman in a a bunker with two men.
Yeah, tight situation.
Yeah. And especially a lot is made of the fact that, like, John Goodman often plays these quite cuddly characters, but in this, the camera never lets you forget that he's quite a large, powerfully built guy, like with big meaty fists that could easily overpower you. And both the others, like Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Emmett, whose actor name I will look up, John Gallagher Jr., they're both quite skinny types.
Right.
And are both injured into the bargain in different ways.
Sure.
So it never lets you forget that there is that threat there, or potential threat if he decides to get violent.
So does she escape? Is that...
She does, yes.
Okay. I'm trying to figure out, like, when you said before, like, if you're the kind of character that's going to just be like, I'm in a bunker and I'm, like, waiting it out.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to be like, I'm going to leave.
Yeah.
I would like to think that I would be the I'm going to get out of here, guys, kind of character, but...
In a way, she's not given a lot of a choice.
Okay. That sounds...
But she's sort of... She's put in that situation because of choices that she makes earlier on.
Right.
In trying to make the best of the situation slash... make sure that she, like, preserve herself.
Yeah. Andy.
Yes.
Are you going to escape the bunker? Or are you going to, like, stay in the bunker with a whole bunch of cans of baked
just
beans?
Just get out. Just chance it.
Yeah. Cabin fever.
What's life if it's entirely spent within a bunker?
That is very profound.
I'd be interested to see how it compares to... Because the last film I saw like that would probably be Room.
I was thinking that.
That's the first film that jumps to mind, like, recently it's come out, which is a very... Yeah, just in a confined space, kind of the psychology that comes with that.
Mm. Weirdly, the thing that the premise reminded me of was The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix.
Really?
Well, only because that the premise of, or at the beginning of that, is that it's a doomsday cult and there's the four women being kept in the bunker because they're being told that the world has ended outside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what's worse, risking going outside and it may be being true that everything is horrible outside and you'll definitely die, but at least you escaped.
Mm.
Or do you stay in the bunker and, like...
live your life in a bunker.
Even if life in the bunker is horrible, do you stay there because it's probably less horrible than the literal apocalypse?
The answer to that question is no. Always take the risk. You can make, you can make the apocalypse work sometimes. It's, you know, it's doable. Don't laugh at me. Come on, guys.
Yeah, no,
come on.
Yeah, a lot of fun to be had.
I feel really bad now, Matt, because obviously I tried to, like... get you to tie in London Has Fallen with this. I was like, yeah, you know, they're both like going on what Cloverfield was. I was like, that's like, we can do that. We can do a nice little segue into London. No, we can't. It doesn't sound like we can do that.
There is no city destruction.
There is no similarity. It's interesting. I wasn't expecting that.
Speaking of apocalypse.
Thanks,
well,
Andy,
I mean, the thing to say about London Has Fallen is you were excited about it because you were like, I want to see some London landmarks get blown up.
Mm, yes, and I did. And I did.
How did it fare?
Seeing London being shown. I didn't enjoy the terrible, terrible CGI of London falling apart. It was very questionable.
Only one landmark got blown up. They blow up Westminster Abbey. Everything else is like a random bridge.
No, they blew up Big Ben. He got annihilated.
Did Big Ben? I don't even
You've
remember
wiped
Big
it
Ben
from your memory. It was
up.
That bad that Matt has actually wiped it from his memory. It was, to be fair, it was a terrible, terrible film. But I still enjoyed it. Because it was just a, you know, you just sit there and you're like, oh, this is just a really bad action film. That's fine with me. I'm okay with that.
I don't mind a bad action film, but I think this one took itself too seriously.
Oh, God, yeah.
Way too
And I think one thing that I spoke about with Alex, because we saw it together, was that we thought that the filmmakers were cleverer than the audience that they were sort of putting this out to. Like, there were some choices that were made that you were like, oh, you just dumbed that down for the audience that you're putting this film out to. Like, I feel like it was trying to go somewhere, but it just never really got there. It just never sort of hit its stride in that sense. And also, the other issue I had was that it was just a bit racist.
Yep.
Which, you know, when you're watching a film, you don't ever want to have that question mark hanging over your head. Is this racist or not? The answer was yes.
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 All the good guys are white and all the bad guys are brown people with beards.
Yes, it was. And I think the most concerning thing for me is that we'll look back on this kind of film in 20 years and go, we shouldn't have done that. Like, it's sometimes you've just got to go, that's poor taste, yeah. And let's not make that kind of film.
It's a movie that is super gung-ho about drone strikes and is very like, America, drone strikes are great. They're an excellent way to take out a single guy while blowing up a whole wedding at the same time.
Yes. A lot of civilian casualties.
Like, there is a sensitive, interesting movie to be made about the ethics of drone strikes in current warfare, and I think that sensitive ethical movie is probably going to be Eye in the Sky, which is out in like 3 or 4 weeks with Helen Mirren, Barhad Abdi, I think his name is, and the late great Alan Rickman.
I think is that his last film?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a good segue though, Matt, because I feel like that might come up on the show and you might review that in...
Probably not next show, because I don't think it's out in time, but probably the one after that.
Yeah.
And I'll probably make some more comparisons to London Has Fallen then.
Brilliant. We look forward to that. I'm so sorry that you had to go and see that film. I enjoyed it, but I only paid £5 to see it, so, you know, sort of swings and roundabouts. Next show, what's the plan?
So I've seen High Rise with Tom Hiddleston, so I might review that if I don't get time to go and see anything else. Obviously, the big release at the moment is Batman v Superman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not very eager to see it, given that I was kind of sceptical to begin with, and the reviews seem to be bearing me out that
it's been
garbage.
Slammed, absolutely slammed.
A Zack Snyder movie was terrible.
Oh, it's quite funny because everyone's just like, it's a pile of trash. But everyone was so excited, and they did that like funny, weird marketing campaign with like Turkish Airlines or whatever.
I've never seen
like,
a movie this hyped for this long.
I know.
Like,
yeah.
The studios so need this to work.
It's not going to work. It's not worked.
So there's that. There's the Snow White and the Huntsman sequel, where they've axed Snow White and just made Chris Hemsworth the main character.
It's just the Huntsman.
Yeah. Or Eddie the Eagle, maybe. I might go and see that, because that seems like the most feel-good and least horrible of the
Let's see a feel-good one. I feel like we need to see a fun, nice film.
And I saw Deadpool, which took the mickey out of Hugh Jackman over and over again, so I feel like I should go and see a Hugh Jackman movie to make up.
Is Hugh Jackman doing Australian Hugh Jackman, or is
he
being American?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. I like him as Australian Hugh Jackman. He's my fave. Okay. Thank you, Matt, for a double review just then. We are going to go into Great Expectations shortly. But first, I'm going to tell you what is coming up for Blackshore. We have sort of talked about Black Shark. I think Alex Pankhurst was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about the May production that we're putting on as a part of WAF. So Black Shark is going to be coming up from the 11th to the 19th of May at the Bedford in Balham. Andy will be there.
Yep.
You'll be doing... What are you going to be doing there, Andy?
Take a guess.
You're going to be doing some tech stuff?
I'll be doing some tech. I'll be doing some sound, some lighting, just all of it. Yeah.
That's your fave, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I do.
Have you been sourcing a lot of bird calls?
They'll be coming. They're on their way. Don't worry.
A lot of beach sounds?
Just there in the bedroom, just crying out like a crow or a seagull. Just...
I really thought you were going to give us a...
I wasn't going to.
Yeah.
I thought about it.
I saw it in your eyes. It's going to give us a bird call.
This is live. I can't edit this later, so...
No, you cannot. Also, your levels are way too high to be doing bird calls into your microphone right now, my friend. Anyway, so if you want to go and see Black Shark, come along and see it. Andy will be there. I'll probably be there. Tickets are online at blackshoreonline.com. And now I'm going to ask you some questions, Andy, about how much fun you had making Great Expectations for us. How much fun was it on a scale of 1 to 10?
On a scale of 1 to 10, it's there's a lot of it's a rollercoaster of emotions doing something like this, because you have the start off, which you're up for the whole day recording, which was a lot of fun.
Mm.
It was very intense. It was pretty exhausting.
Yeah.
And that was over. That was like all pumped to get the show out, and then you realise there's months of editing sprawled out ahead of you, which it's quite intimidating, I'm not going to lie. Once I got started and realised just how much work that was going to take, then there was the level of from 1 to 10 probably plummeted quite severely. But then I got into it. So
peaks and troughs, I feel, has been a thing. I think you've heard us talk about this a lot as we've been playing out Great Expectations, but we did all the recording in one day, and then, you know, producers like myself just stepped away from the whole project and handed it off to Andy and said, can you just make soundscapes that make it sound like it's London back in, you know, in Great Expectations time? And you're like, yeah, I can do that. I'm really excited about that. Oh, God.
Yeah, it was
4 months in.
It's been a long process, but it's been at the same time because of that. It's felt like quite an achievement, really, to be honest.
So. Oh, it's been a fantastic achievement from your perspective alone. I mean, I don't know anyone that's done anything on this scale. We've never done anything on this scale, and it was just you,
especially as a volunteer as well.
Yeah.
You're just Andy has just done all of this in his spare time.
Yeah. I mean, I was only told yesterday as a volunteer, so I'm pretty gutted, to be honest.
We can take that to higher up after the show. I'm sorry about that.
It's been a lot of fun.
Bit of miscommunication.
Yeah, my housemates have seen me go slightly insane. They caught me the other week for this final episode, just in my own bathroom with a towel rack over the bath and some towels covering it and the microphone pointing at water splashing about in that and wondering what was wrong with me, to be honest. But that's what you've got to do for
art. Here's a question. What is the weirdest sound effect? Is that the weirdest sound effect you've had to make for this
one? That's close. There is a scene that requires some female screaming that you will hear later in this episode, which I did attempt to do myself. I realised that sounded bad.
Okay.
So I spent about 3 hours then going through the archives of sounds that I've accumulated and editing something to sound like a female scream.
Did you not have any females to hand?
I did not, no.
Oh dear.
I know, it's... You
could have just gone out into the street and accosted someone.
Attacked someone and recorded the scream.
Oh, we don't condone any...
Don't condone it. And I paid them later, just like...
Of course, as long as there's money changing hands, that's okay.
I've made sure they weren't upset at the end of it or traumatised, but...
Yeah. And say that, you know...
Recorder. I just have an image of you in my head now, Andy, like with a microphone in one hand going, "Scream for me."
That has occurred several times. My housemates weren't too receptive to that again.
I apologize for how much this whole project has made you look like a crazy person.
Yeah.
And really, you know, turned you maybe slightly insane. But I think you can be really proud of it at the same time.
I'm pulling back the sanity now. I'm having a break. Back to normality.
And he's having a well-deserved break before he goes and does some lights and sound for Black Truck in
next
May.
Show.
Yeah. I promise to our listeners, we're actually planning on maybe doing Black Truck on the radio, which I think you'll be fine with because it's a bit shorter.
It's a bit shorter. We've got the show first, so I'll be able to do it in stages, which is nice.
This one's like less scary and. So I think with all of that information that we now have from how Andy is a bit of a broken man after editing all of Great Expectations, without further ado, we're going to play you the very, very last episode.
Great Expectations, Episode 7.
I turned from the temple gate as soon as I had read the warning. It was plain that I must see Wemmick before seeing anyone else, and equally plain that his Walworth sentiments only could be taken.
You did come home, then?
Yes, but I didn't go home.
Now, Mr. Pym, you know, we are in our private and personal capacities. I accidentally heard yesterday morning, being in a certain place, that a certain person, not altogether of uncolonial pursuits and not unpossessed of portable property, we won't name this person.
Not necessary.
Had made some little stir in a certain part of the world where a good many people go, not always in gratification of their own inclinations and not quite irrespective of the government expense, by disappearing from such a place and being no more heard of thereabouts. I also heard that you, at your chambers, had been watched and might be watched again.
You have heard of a man of bad character whose true name is Compeyson.
He nodded at me once.
Is he living?
Another nod.
Is he in London?
He gave me one other nod.
Now, questioning being over, I come to what I did. Not finding you, I went to find Mr. Herbert, and, without going into any details, I gave him to understand that if he was aware of anybody, Tom, Jack or Richard, being about the chambers, he had better get Tom, Jack or Richard out of the way while you were out of the way.
He would be greatly puzzled what to do.
He was puzzled what to do, not the less because I gave him my opinion that it was not safe to try to get Tom, Jack or Richard too far out of the way at present. Don't break cover too soon. Lie close. Wait till things slacken before you try the open, even for foreign air. Mr. Herbert mentioned to me that he is courting a young lady who lives by the riverside between Limehouse and Greenwich. Mr. Herbert put it to me, what did I think of that as a temporary tenement for Tom, Jack or Richard? Now I thought very well of it. Here's the address. There can be no harm in you going here tonight, but after you have gone home, don't go back here. Let me finally impress one important point upon you. Avail yourself to lay hold of his portable property. Don't let anything happen to the portable property.
I found that the spot I wanted was anything but easy to find. It was called Mill Pond Bank. In his two cabin rooms at the top of the house, I found Provis comfortably settled.
I have talked with Wemmick and have come to tell you what caution he gave me and what advice.
This I did, accurately. I added that when the time came for getting him abroad, I should go with him.
We are both good watermen, Handel. We could take him down the river and get Provis aboard the foreign steamer ourselves when the right time comes. No boat would then be hired for the purpose, and no boatman. That would save at least a chance of suspicion.
We agreed that the scheme should be carried into execution.
I don't like to leave you here, though I cannot doubt your being safer here than near me. Goodbye.
Dear boy, I don't know when we may meet again, and I don't like goodbye. Say goodnight.
Good night. When the time comes, you may be certain I shall be ready. Good night. Good night.
Next day, I set myself to get the boat and began to go out as for training and practice. Still, I could not get rid of the notion of being watched. Once received, it is a haunting idea. Some weeks passed without bringing any change. We waited for Wemmick, and he made no sign. I was pressed for money by more than one creditor, but I had quite determined that it would be heartless fraud to take more money from my patron. Therefore, I had sent him the unopened pocketbook by Herbert to hold in his own keeping. One afternoon, I was strolling along Cheapside when a large hand was laid upon my shoulder. It was Mr. Jaggers's hand.
Come and dine with me, Mr. Pip. Wemmick's coming.
As soon as we got there, dinner was served.
Did you send that note of Miss Havisham's to Mr. Pip, Wemmick?
No, sir. Here it is.
She tells me that she wants to see you on a little matter of business you mentioned to her. You'll go down?
Yes.
So, Pip, our friend Mr. Drummle has played his cards. He has won the pool. Ha! He is a promising fellow, but he may not have it all his own way. The stronger will win in the end, but the stronger has to be found out first. So here's to Mrs. Bentley Drummle, and may the question of supremacy be settled to the lady's satisfaction. Now, Molly! Molly, 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 how slow you are today.
His housekeeper was at his elbow immediately. A certain action of her fingers arrested my attention. I looked at those hands. I looked at those eyes. I looked at that hair. And I compared them with other hands, other eyes, other hair. And I felt absolutely certain that this woman was Estella's mother. Wemmick and I took our leave together.
Wemmick, do you remember telling me before to notice Mr. Jaggers's housekeeper?
I dare say I did.
I wish you would tell me her story.
We are in our private and personal capacities, of course.
Putting Miss Havisham's note in my pocket, I went down again by the coach the next day. The best light of the day was gone when I passed along the quiet, echoing courts behind the high street. The cathedral chimes had at once a sadder and a more remote sound to me, and seemed to call to me that the place was changed, and that Estella was gone out of it forever.
You said, speaking for your friend, that you could tell me how to do something useful and good, something that you would like done, is it not?
Something that I would like done very much.
How much money is wanting it to complete the purchase?
£900.
Can I only serve you, Pip, by serving your friend? Is there nothing I can do for you yourself?
Nothing. I thank you for the question, I thank you even more for the tone of the question. But there is nothing.
She took from her pocket a yellow set of ivory tablets and wrote upon them with a pencil.
This is an authority to Mr. Jaggers to pay you that money. For your friend.
Thank you, Miss Havisham.
My name is on the first leaf. If you could ever write under my name, I forgive her. Pray do it.
Oh, Miss Havisham, I can do it now. There have been sore mistakes, and my life has been a blind and thankless one. But I want forgiveness and direction far too much to be bitter with you.
She turned her face to me and, to my amazement, dropped on her knees at my feet.
Oh, what have I done? What have I done? Until you spoke to her the other day, and I saw in you a looking glass that showed me what I once felt myself. I did not know what I had done. What have I done? What have I done?
Miss Havisham, you may dismiss me from your mind and conscience, but Estella is a different case.
Yes, yes, I know it, but Pip, my dear, believe this. When she first came to me, I meant to save her from misery like my own.
Miss Havisham, does what has passed between us give me any excuse for asking you a question relative to Estella?
Go on.
Whose child was Estella?
She shook her head.
You don't know?
She shook her head again.
But Mr. Jaggers brought her here or sent her here?
Brought her here.
Might I ask her age then?
2 or 3.
I resolved to walk round the place before leaving, for I had a presentiment that I should never be there again. Before departing, I resolved to go upstairs and assure myself that Miss Havisham was as safe and well as I had left her. In the moment when I was withdrawing my head to go quietly away, I saw a great flaming light spring up. In the same moment, I saw her running at me, shrieking, with a whirl of fire blazing all about her, and soaring at least as many feet above her head as she was high. I had a coat on, and over my arm another thick coat. Then I got them off, closed with her, threw her down, and got them over her. Then I dragged the great cloth from the table for the same purpose, and with it dragged down the heap of rottenness in the midst, and all the ugly things that sheltered there. That this occurred I knew through the result, but not through anything I felt, or thought, or knew I did. I knew nothing until I knew that we were on the floor by the great table, and that patches of tinder yet were floating in the smoky air, which, a moment ago, had been her faded bridal dress. Assistance was sent for, and I held her until it came. When I got up, I was astonished to see that both my hands were burnt. An hour afterwards, she lay indeed where she had said that she would lie one day. Towards midnight, she began to wander in her speech, and after that it gradually set in that she said innumerable times in a low, solemn voice,
"What have I done?"
And then,
"When she first came, I meant to save her from misery like mine."
And then,
"Take the pencil and write under my name. I forgive her."
Herbert, who was the kindest of nurses, did his utmost to hold my attention engaged.
Lay your arm out upon the back of the sofa, my dear boy, and I'll get the bandages off so that you shall not know when it comes. I was speaking of Provis. Do you know Handel? He improves.
I said to you I thought he was softened when I last saw him.
Yes, you remember his breaking off here about some woman that he had got into great trouble with. How did I hurt you?
I had forgotten that, Herbert, but I remember it now you speak of it.
Well, he went into that part of his life, and a dark, wild part it is. It seems that the woman was a jealous woman, and a revengeful woman. Revengeful, Handel, to the last degree.
To what last degree?
A murder. Or does it strike too cold on that sensitive place?
I don't feel it. How did she murder? Whom did she murder?
Why, the deed may not have merited quite so terrible a name, but she was tried for it, and Mr. Jaggers defended her. It was another and a stronger woman who was the victim, and there had been a struggle in a barn.
Was the woman brought in guilty?
No, no, she was acquitted. Oh, my poor Handel, I hurt you!
It is impossible to be gentler, Herbert. Yes, what else?
This acquitted young woman and Provis had a little child. On the evening when the object of her jealousy was strangled, the young woman presented herself before Provis and swore that she would destroy the child and he should never see it again. Then she vanished. You don't think your breathing is affected, my dear boy? You seem to breathe quickly.
Perhaps I do, Herbert. I want to know, and particularly, Herbert, whether he told you when this happened.
Particularly? Well, how old were you when you came upon him in the little churchyard?
I think in my 7th year.
Aye, it had happened some 3 or 4 years then, he said, and you brought into his mind the little girl so tragically lost, who would have been about your age.
Herbert, can you see me best by the light of the window or the light of the fire?
By the firelight.
Look at me.
I do look at you, my dear boy.
You are not afraid that I am in any fever, or that my head is much disordered by the accident of last night?
No, my dear boy, you are rather excited, but you are quite yourself.
I know I am quite myself. And the man we have in hiding down the river is Estella's father.
I arrived in Little Britain early next morning and produced Miss Havisham's authority to receive the £900 for Herbert.
I'm sorry, Pip, that we do nothing for you.
Miss Havisham was good enough to ask me whether she could do nothing for me, and I told her no.
Everybody should know his own business. I should not have told her no if I had been you.
I did ask something of Miss Havisham, however, sir. I asked her to give me some information relative to her adopted daughter, and she gave me all she possessed.
Did she? Ha! I don't think I should have done so. If I had been Miss Havisham... But she ought to know her business best.
I know more of the history of Miss Havisham's adopted child than Miss Havisham herself does, sir. I know her mother.
Mother?
I have seen her mother within these 3 days.
Yes.
And you have seen her still more recently.
Yes.
Perhaps I know more of Estella's history than even you do. I know her father, too.
So, you know the young lady's father, Pip?
Yes, and his name is Provis from New South Wales.
And on what evidence, Pip, does Provis make this claim?
Oh, he does not make it, and has never made it, and has no knowledge that his daughter is in existence.
I'll put a case to you. Mind, I admit nothing.
Of course.
Now, Pip, put the case that a woman held her child concealed and was obliged to communicate the fact to her legal adviser. Put the case that at the same time he held a trust to find a child for an eccentric rich lady to adopt and bring up.
I follow you, sir.
Put the case that pretty nigh all the children he saw in his daily business life he had reason to look upon as so much spawn to develop into the fish that were to come to his net. To be prosecuted, forsworn, made orphans, bedeviled somehow.
I follow you, sir.
Put the case, Pip, that here was one pretty little child out of the heap who could be saved. Put the case that this was done and that the woman was cleared.
I understand you perfectly.
But I make no admissions.
But that you make no admissions.
Put the case, Pip, that the child grew up, that the mother was still living, that the father was still living, that the secret was still a secret, except that you had got wind of it. Put that last case to yourself very carefully.
I do.
For whose sake would you reveal the secret? For the father's? I think he would not be much the better for the mother. For the mother's? I think if she had done such a deed, she would be safer where she was. For the daughter's? I think it would hardly serve her to establish her parentage and to drag her back to disgrace. But... add the case that you had loved her, Pip, then I tell you that you had better chop off that bandaged left hand of yours with your bandaged right hand, and then pass the chopper on to Wemmick there to cut that off too.
We had got into the month of March when I received the following letter from Wemmick.
Burn this as soon as read. Early in the week, or say Wednesday, you might do what you know of if you felt disposed to try it. Now burn.
We found that a steamer for Hamburg was likely to suit our purpose best. Wednesday morning dawned. It was one of those March days when the sun shines hot and the wind blows cold, when it is summer in the light and winter in the shade. Old London Bridge was soon passed, and the White Tower and Traitor's Gate, and we were among the tiers of shipping. And now I could see, with a faster beating heart, Mill Pond Bank. We touched the stairs lightly for a single moment, and he was on board and we were off again.
If you know, dear boy, what it is to sit here longer, my dear boy, after having been day by day betwixt four walls, you'd envy me. But you don't know what it is.
If all goes well, you will be perfectly free and safe again within a few hours.
Well, I hope so. But we can no more see the bottom of these next few hours than we can see the bottom of this river.
We persevered and rowed and rowed and rowed until the sun went down. We rowed out into the track of the steamer. But it was more than half an hour before we saw her smoke. As they were coming on at full speed, we got the bags ready, and we were taking that opportunity of saying goodbye when I saw a four-oared galley shoot out from under the bank, but a little way ahead of us. The galley crossed us, let us come up with her, and fell alongside. She kept alongside, drifting when we drifted, pulling a stroke or two when we pulled. The steamer was nearing us very fast, and the beating of her paddles grew louder and louder. I felt as if her shadow were absolutely upon us.
You have a return transport there. His name is Abel Magwitch. I apprehend that man and call upon him to surrender and you to assist.
They ran the galley aboard us. I heard them calling to us from the steamer and heard the order given to stop the paddles. But I felt her driving down on us irresistibly. In the same moment, I saw the prisoner start up, lean across his captor, and pull the cloak from off his neck. Still in the same moment, I saw that the face disclosed was the face of the other convict of long ago. Still in the same moment, I heard a great cry on board the steamer and a loud splash in the water and felt the boat sink from under me. An instant later, I was on board the galley. The two convicts were gone. Presently, a dark object was seen in the water, bearing towards us on the tide. I saw it to be Magwitch. He was taken on board and instantly manacled at the wrists and ankles. He had received some very severe injury in the chest and a deep cut in the head. My repugnance to him now had all melted away, and in the hunted, wounded, shackled creature who held my hand in his, I only saw a man who had meant to be my benefactor. I only saw in him a much better man than I had been to Joe. As we returned, I told him how grieved I was to think that he had come home for my sake.
Dear boy, I'm quite content to take my chance. I've seen my boy, and he can be a gentleman without me.
No. I had thought about that. No. I understood Wemmick's hint now. I foresaw that, being convicted, his possessions would be forfeited to the Crown. Compeyson's body was found many miles from the scene of his death, and so horribly disfigured that he was only recognisable by the contents of his pockets. Magwitch was taken to the police court and committed to take his trial at the next session. It was at this dark time of my life that Herbert returned one evening, a good deal cast down.
My dear Handel, I fear I shall soon have to leave you. We shall lose a fine opportunity if I put off going to Cairo, and I am very much afraid I must go, Handel, when you most need me.
Herbert, I shall always need you, because I shall always love you. But my need is no greater now than at another time.
My dear fellow, let the near prospect of our separation be my justification for troubling you about yourself. Have you thought about your future?
No, for I have been afraid to think of any future.
Oh, but yours cannot be dismissed. In this branch house of ours, Handel, we must have
a clerk.
A clerk? And I hope it is not at all unlikely that he may expand, as a clerk of your acquaintance has expanded, into a partner.
Herbert, if you could, leave the question open for a little while.
Oh, for any while, 6 months, a year.
Not so long as that, 2 or 3 months at most.
Provis lay in prison very ill. The trial was very short and very clear. At that time, it was the custom to make a finishing effect with the sentences of death. I can scarcely believe that I saw 32 men and women put before the judge to receive that sentence together. As the days went on, I noticed more and more that he would lie placidly looking at the white ceiling with an absence of light in his face.
Dear boy, I thought you was late, but I knowed you couldn't be that.
It is just the time. I waited for it at the gate.
You always wait at the gate, don't you, dear boy?
Yes, not to lose a moment of the time.
Thank you, dear boy, thank you. God bless you. You've never deserted me, dear boy.
Are you in much pain today?
I don't complain of much, dear boy.
You never do complain.
He had spoken his last words.
Dear Magwitch, I must tell you now at last. You understand what I say?
A gentle pressure on my hand.
You had a daughter once whom you loved and lost.
A stronger pressure on my hand.
She lived. She is living now. She is a lady and very beautiful, and I love her.
With a last faint effort, he raised my hand to his lips. Then he gently let it sink upon his breast.
Lord, be merciful to him, a sinner.
Now I was left wholly to myself. I was in debt and had scarcely any money. I should have been alarmed if I had had energy and concentration enough to help me to the clear perception of any truth beyond the fact that I was falling very ill.
Old chap, what a scholar you are, ain't you?
I should like to be.
This is Pip, is it?
And be brought up Pip. As Mira. A gentleman. In
Let
a word,
look at you.
As a young fellow,
you are not
a great expectation.
You must know that you have no heart.
Not a plenty of people anywhere here for their best of friends and us, Pip.
I opened my eyes and I saw in the great chair at my bedside, Joe.
Is it Joe?
Which it air, old chap?
Oh, Joe, you break my heart. Look angry at me, Joe. Strike me, Joe. Tell me of my ingratitude. Don't be so good to me.
Which dear old Pip, old chap? You and me was ever friends, and when you're well enough to go out for a ride, what larks!
God bless him. Oh, God bless this gentle Christian man. How long, dear Joe?
Which you mean to say, Pip, how long have your illness lasted, dear old chap?
Yes, Joe.
It's the end of May, Pip. Tomorrow is the 1st of June.
And have you been here all this time, Joe?
Pretty nigh, old chap. Ever the best of friends, and us, Pip.
When I got up in the morning, refreshed and stronger, I went to his room, but he was not there. I hurried then to the breakfast table, and on it found a letter.
Not wishful to intrude, I have departed, for you are well again, dear Pip, and will do better without. P.S. Ever the best of friends, Joe.
Enclosed in the letter was a receipt for the debts and costs which I had owed. What remained for me now but to follow him to the dear old forge? And I would go to Biddy, and I would show her how humbled and repentant I came back. Then I would say to her,
Biddy, if you can like me only half as well once more, if you can receive me like a forgiven child, I hope I am a little worthier of you now than I was.
The June weather was delicious, and I thought all that countryside more beautiful and peaceful than I had ever known it. I went towards the forge, listening for the clink of Joe's hammer. But the clink of Joe's hammer was not in the midsummer wind. I saw the forge at last, and saw that it was closed. I went softly towards the window, meaning to peep in, when Joe and Biddy stood before me, arm in arm. In another moment, she was in my embrace.
Oh, but, dear Biddy, how smart you are!
Yes, dear Pip.
And Joe, how smart you are!
Yes, dear Pip, old chap.
It's my wedding day and I'm married to Joe.
Dear Biddy, you have the best husband in the whole world. And Joe, you have the best wife in the whole world. And Joe and Biddy both. Receive my humble thanks for all that you have done and for all I have so ill repaid. And when I say that I am going away, for I am soon going abroad now, though I know you have already done it in your own kind hearts, pray, tell me both, that you forgive me?
Oh, dear old Pip, old chap, God knows as I forgive you, if I have anything to forgive.
Amen. And God knows I do.
I sold all I had, and I went out and joined Herbert. Within a month, I had quitted England, and within 2 months, I was clerk to Clarica and Co. For 11 years, I did not see Joe or Biddy with my bodily eyes when, upon an evening in December, an hour or two after dark, I laid my hand softly on the latch of the old kitchen door. There, smoking his pipe in the old place, sat Joe. And there, sitting on my own little stool, looking at the fire, was I, again.
We give him the name of Pip for your sake, dear old chap, and we hoped he might grow a little bit like you.
Biddy, you must give Pip to me one of these days, or lend him at all events.
No, no, you must marry.
So Herbert says, but I don't think I shall, Biddy. I am already quite an old bachelor.
Dear Pip, tell me, as an old friend, have you quite forgotten her?
My dear Biddy, I have forgotten nothing in my life that ever had a foremost place there. But that poor dream, as I once used to call it, has all gone by, Biddy, all gone by.
Nevertheless, I knew while I said those words that I intended to revisit the site of the old house, alone, for her sake. Yes, even so, for Estella's sake. I had heard of her as leading a most unhappy life, and as being separated from her husband, who had used her with great cruelty. And I had heard of the death of her husband from an accident consequent on his ill-treatment of a horse. This release had befallen her some 2 years before. For anything I knew, she was married again. There was no house now, no building whatever left, but the wall of the old garden. I was looking along the desolate garden walk when I beheld a solitary figure in it.
Pip?
Estella?
I am greatly changed. I wonder you know me.
After so many years, it is strange that we should thus meet again, Estella. Here, where our first meeting was.
The moon began to rise, and I thought of the pressure on my hand when I had spoken the last words he had heard on earth.
I have often thought of you.
Have you?
Of late, very often. I little thought that I should take leave of you in taking leave of this spot. I am very glad to do so.
Glad to part again, Estella. To me, parting is a painful thing. To me, remembrance of our last parting has ever been mournful and painful.
But you said to me, God bless you, God forgive you. And if you could say that to me then, you will not hesitate to say that to me now. Now, when suffering has been stronger than all other teaching, and has taught me to understand what your heart used to be. I have been bent and broken, but I hope into a better shape. Be as considerate and good to me as you were, and tell me we are friends.
We are friends.
And we'll continue friends apart.
I took her hand in mine, and we went out of the ruined place. And, as the morning mists had risen long ago when I first left the forge, so the evening mists were rising now, and in all the broad expanse of tranquil light they showed to me, I saw the shadow of no parting from her. Thank you.
You've been listening to Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, adapted by Marcus Baisley, produced as a collaboration between Blackshaw Theatre and Cyphers. The narrator was played by Jeremy Drakes, Magwitch and Pumblechook by Dylan Lincoln, Compeyson, Porter and Galley by Marcus J. Baisley, Estella and Mrs. Joe by Victoria Hamblin, Pip by Rupert Sadler, Joe, Wemmick and Drummle by Christopher Anderton, Sergeant and Jaggers by Alexander Pankhurst, Miss Havisham by Jessica Bryan, Herbert Pocket by William Holyhead, and Biddy by Rosie Marsh. Sound recording and design by Andrew Crane. Produced by Helen Johnson and Aisha Chapman.
You have just been listening to the final episode of Great Expectations. That was fantastic, Andy. Thank you. Well done.
I'm an emotional wreck.
I'm crying a little bit inside. Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the end of Great Expectations and also nearly to the end of the Blackshaw Arts Hour for another week. In 2 weeks' time, you will be able to understand the context of this.
I am my own bum double.
And is that written into your contract?
It depends. It depends. Amazing. I don't mind sharing a bum. I mean, it felt appropriate for the show.
We've got an interview coming up in 2 weeks, and that will all make sense to you. I could not help but promo this interview that we have coming up with that, because that is just the most beautiful soundbite. It's fantastic. So yes, tune in 2 weeks' time to the Blackshaw Arts Hour to hear that interview. Ellie Pitkin is interviewing our mystery guest, and it's going to be very great. And then the next show that we've got coming up is Black Shuck. Obviously, we're going to be hearing from Duncan Hands, who wrote Black Shuck, next week as well. Not next week, in a fortnight. Still can't wrap my head around that. And the most immediate thing coming up for Blackshaw is going to be our new writing night on Wednesday. This coming Wednesday. It is on at the Horse and Stables in Lambeth. You can get a pre-ordered ticket for £4 if you go onto our Facebook page and follow the links down to new writing night. Or you can pay a fiver on the door. And it is well worth seeing because it is actually our showcase new writing night. So all of these fantastic pieces will, well, one lucky piece from the night on Wednesday will get a whole bunch of special treatment over a year, and then it'll be put on as a showcase award industry one night only. Lots of words I just said there, but you get the gist.
And if you come along, you can maybe try and influence that decision.
You can.
Through your feedback.
Yes, we love feedback.
We want to know which one lands the best with audiences and what people appreciate and are looking for.
Exactly. And if you would like to come down and give Andy an actual pat on the back for his fantastic work, you can do that because he'll be there.
I'll be there.
He'll be with his headphones on. Yeah. Doing what he does best.
More tech, yeah.
Well, guys, we're done. Thank you so much for joining me again on the show. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
And we will be back on Wandsworth Radio in 2 weeks' time. Bye, guys.
Night. Bye.